Radhika Jones, editor-in-chief of Vanity Fair. If you enjoy binge-watching the best TV shows and love hearing from the actors and showrunners who make them happen, then subscribe to Vanity Fair. Our Hollywood reporters take you behind the scenes of the year's most anticipated projects, the industry's biggest moves, and the hardest-fought awards races. From The Crown to The Real Housewives, we've got the inside scoop. As a special thank you to our still-watching audience, we're offering 15% off a yearly digital subscription to Vanity Fair. Visit vanityfair.com today and use promo code POD15. That's vanityfair.com, promo code POD15, for 15% off a yearly digital subscription to everything you want.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive. Are you driving your car or doing laundry right now? Podcasts go best when they're bundled with another activity. Like Progressive home and auto policies, they're best when they're bundled too. Having these two policies together makes insurance easier and could help you save. Customers who save by switching their home and car insurance to Progressive save nearly $800 on average. Quote a home and car bundle today at progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $793 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2021 and May 2022. Potential savings will vary.
Hello and welcome to Still Watching, a weekly television podcast from Vanity Fair. I'm Richard Lawson.
And I'm Chris Murphy. We're here to discuss the second episode of the HBO series, The White Lotus, Mike White's darkly funny series about class, death, and choking on a bug on the back of a Vespa.
Which would be me, if I were ever foolish enough to get on a Vespa.
Okay, I'd be on the front, you'd be on the back.
Full bugs.
Dressed as Monica Vitti, yeah. Inhaling
Scratching
bugs.
My tongue.
I see it. I see that for us.
The episode we're talking about today is episode 2, Italian Dream. Other than Vespa bugs, we have Portia and Albie going on dinner together and having a kind of intense conversation about sex and gender, but they don't really realize that's the conversation they're having, maybe. We have poor Dominic falling deeper into the well of what might be sex addiction. We have possibly some sort of plot involving Tanya and Greg, which could lead us to more discussion about who dies.
Yes.
And then we have a conversation that you did with Beatrice Grano.
Yes, I talked to the actress that plays Mia about her big musical moment, which might involve a Haim sister.
Ooh.
It's kind of crazy.
Gotta stay tuned for Haim. So, Chris, let's talk about the episode kind of in a broader sense before we get into the details of it. For me, and maybe you disagree, I think the kind of thesis part of this episode is when Portia and Albie are at dinner.
Mm.
And, of course, Portia's keeping an eye on Tanya in the corner, having yet another meltdown. And they're talking kind of guardedly at first about, like, I think they're trying to suss each other out. Like, are you single? Like, what kind of people do you like?
Light flirting is happening.
Yeah. And Portia goes on this kind of fraught monologue about, like, how she's sick of TikTok and Bumble. Mm. And she wants someone who's ignorant of the discourse. And she needs to up her meds. And she just wants to have adventure.
Yes.
And
she wants a caveman. She basically,
right,
she basically wants a caveman.
I just want to have fun. I just want to, I don't know, feel, like, fulfilled and have an adventure. And, like, I'm sick of fucking TikTok and Bumble and just screens and apps and sitting there binging Netflix. And I just want to, like, live. I just want to live my life so badly. I just feel like I just want to meet someone who's, like, you know, totally ignorant of the discourse, you know?
Right, like someone who lives in a cave, like a caveman.
Yeah, I would date a caveman at this point.
I mean, I think you could aim higher, honestly. I think you could do better than a caveman.
And right there, I think, is where this relationship seems to be turning, which is, like, there was a mutual attraction, but complex matters of, like, life in the 21st century, gender dynamics as they exist now, like, come to bear on this. And you kind of, I mean, here's what I think.
Yeah.
I think Portia is, like, I hate that I want this kind of like asshole that Albie has just described.
Mm-hmm.
And yet that promises more adventure than this nice kid next to me, across from me does.
He's trying to be sort of this perfect, you know, Gen Z appropriate, you know, woman loving, consenting man.
The opposite of his dad.
The opposite of his dad.
Yeah.
Which, as you said, it seems like it's not exactly what Portia wants. She wants a caveman. She wants somebody who's away from the discourse, and Albie's whole personality is sort of shaped by the discourse
right,
in
right.
a weird way.
Right.
And yet, I know I'm still rooting for them. I mean, and then you see the kiss at the end, right? You know,
yeah.
He like asks for consent to kiss her, which, while very sweet in some ways, that's not like the sexiest way to have a first kiss.
Right. It's tricky. And I think that White is such a good writer because he's sharp and satirical about these dynamics, but sensitive to both sides as
mm-hmm.
well. Like, you know, he understands where Portia's coming from in terms of like everything feels so clinical and safe and
yes.
sterile and like, and so kind of preordained in a way. Like, you have to behave this set of ways in order for things to be.
Yes. That's what the culture is dictating right now.
And, you know, and you get that feeling that like, where is the old adventure? Like, where is the kind of transgressiveness of mm-hmm. the past? And on the other side, you have Albie, who's like, yeah, I mean, like, what is he supposed to do? He's a young man in the world who's receiving all of these signals
yes.
about, like, the problems of male behavior, toxic masculinity. And so he's doing what a conscientious person kind of does in that situation, which is, like, listen and
yeah.
learn.
He's listening and learning, yeah. and yet it's completely nice guys finish last, which is sort
yeah.
of, like, I don't think that's necessarily the thesis that Mike White believes in. I don't think, as you said, I think he does a really great job of being fair to both sides. Like, he doesn't come down as, like, Portia's right to want a caveman or Albie's right to want to be sort of a more evolved, you know, man in the world. But these two things are at tension with each other, sort of, you know, being politically correct or, like, culturally sensitive and engaging women, like, you know, humans and the individuals with respect that they are, and also a very real sexual carnal desire to just sort of like, you know, fuck, for
right,
lack of
right.
a better
yeah.
word,
yeah.
with somebody who isn't necessarily the most respectful or politically correct or, you know, who's not checking all the boxes in that way.
And where better to do the vulgar word you just said?
sorry.
In fucking Sicily at this beautiful hotel with this random cute guy you just met, and it's like, here is the moment where you fall into this sort of like roll in the hay kind of mindset. I mean, what is more of a fantasy than that? It made me think about the opening credits.
Ah, okay,
which,
how so?
Start with these kind of like
pastoral
frescoes or whatever that's sort of supposed to be emulating.
Yeah.
And then as the music that beat drops,
as the beat drops,
then you start to see these more carnal little
yes.
scenes, a blowjob, a stabbing, a something, you know, a man ravaging a woman.
Yeah.
Like,
it gets sexier, but also
yeah.
more sort of base and
yeah.
fully carnal.
Which seems to be kind of what this season thus far is about,
mm-hmm.
you know. I think we also, if you want to switch gears over to Ethan and Harper, we see that a similar sort of conversation unfolding. So what for you really stuck out with them this week?
I mean, what stuck out? I'm thinking about Ethan and his sort of mid-morning.
right. Post-exercise.
Jerk-off
yeah.
session. But that did really stick out in terms of explaining their relationship. They also have some trouble connecting, right? The great thing about Harper and the great thing about Aubrey Plaza as an actress, which I think she's doing such great work, is that she never really exactly says what she means. Like, she's very honest and very forthcoming, but you can always, like, read her subtext so well and sort of her disappointment that, you know, instead of, you know, and she actually does say this, that Ethan would rather, you know, pull up internet computer porn rather than, like, wait for her to have sex. That sort of prickliness and yet her inability to sort of, like, be the type of woman who would, like, have sex with him. Like, I don't believe
right,
that, like,
right.
you know, had she been there and he came back, I could see her being like, ew, get away from me, go shower, you know?
Right.
It's that sort of, like, those competing impulses of being, like, she wants to be the type of woman, maybe a little bit like Daphne, who she does sort of disparage, but who's like free and easy and like can just have morning sex and whatnot, but she's not that type
no.
of woman.
No.
And that's such a great sort of dichotomy there.
You know, we have these multiple scenes with Daphne and Cameron where Harper just can't help herself.
She can't.
And says, I'm not materialistic, or, you know, having a kid, you know, bringing a child into this world, like basically mm-hmm. insulting
yeah.
her you know, her companion's lives.
Yeah, it's like sort of to their face, but like in a way without sort of directly being like, I think less of
it. And catching herself.
Yes, and being like, is aware of what she's doing and like is trying to fight that impulse, but like can't. I think Harper's sort of disdain for this sort of, for Cameron and Daphne and this couple that just seems to, you know, be, as she says, seems to be not truthful, seems to be lying about how, you know, easy breezy their relationship is and like, or putting up a front or putting up a facade, right? I do think that her disdain comes from a very real and sort of normal place of being like, these people have everything that like I don't, they're everything that I'm not in a way. And like, I have to poke holes in that to sort of justify the way that I am in the world and the way that I exist in the world. Oh, it's hard to say that Cameron's not an asshole when we see him screaming at employees for, you know, for sending his bags home and then him hitting on Harper in the middle of the ocean. I mean, that was ridiculous. I don't trust I think Cameron and Harper, what did you think about him sort of grabbing her leg in the middle of the ocean and sort of swimming out? Like, that was a little...
Well, we still don't know why Cameron and Daphne invited these people on the trip. We assume, as Harper does, that it has something to do with this new money. And therefore, we could maybe extrapolate a little bit further that Cameron, as much as he keeps shit-talking Harper behind her back, like, he can't alienate this newly very rich guy. He can't alienate his
wife.
You know? So maybe that, I think that maybe Cameron has no idea how to interact with women that isn't either disdain or that.
Yes.
or hitting
on. Full on horniness.
Yeah. You know, and I think, and the funny thing about that is that, like, and I think this kind of nicely ties into the Portia stuff that we just talked about, is that scene at the end when Cameron and Daphne are in their room and she says the thing about, I think that sometimes women cut their husband's balls off and then don't find them sexy anymore and don't understand why. And you're like, and that is, I think, maybe something of what Portia is sort of starting to wrap her head around, this idea of like, how much do you kind of beta your guy or whatever. But clearly that communicates to me that Daphne, what does the cutting the balls off imply? Like, or what does having the balls still intact imply? It's like, go get it. Like that kind of aggression, that male aggression, which like, hopefully is not physical, but like certainly in pursuit of money or business or whatever. So I kind of wonder like, what does Daphne know about the reason for this trip? You know,
How
is she just along for the ride, or is she? Are they kind of like a, you know, Bonnie and Clyde sort of corporate raider types who are just like, she's like, I'll play my part, you play yours, and we're going to get this deal done.
But ultimately, now Harper and Ethan are, you know, in their in the money ranking are above them.
But Harper thinks we're LARPing as rich people.
Yes,
you know, so that's those are two marriages that seem to be, at least steady in their dysfunction, let's say. Then we have Tanya and Greg. My sensor for, like, Jennifer Coolidging it up a little too much or Mike White kind of overwriting Tanya is pretty sensitive, you know? And it pinged a little bit in this episode.
Oh, God. This is such a beautiful view. I wonder if anyone's ever jumped from here.
How did it land for you?
That is like a perfect sort of calibrated Jennifer Coolidge to me. And that just sort of is like, I'm so happy Tanya's here.
Yeah.
But then I felt until we got to her big dinner scene with Greg, I was a little bit like, okay, we're spending a lot of time on this Vespa. We're doing a lot, you know, the Monica Vitti thing, the Instagram pictures.
And Valentina's like calling her Peppa the Pig.
That
and you're
is
like,
also
like,
unbelievable.
That's, I get that Valentina's supposed to be blunt, but like, who are we laughing at now and how are we laughing at them? That's my sort of, always the eternal question with this character and this performance. But also the I'm glad you brought up the thing of like, I wonder if anyone's jumped. That sudden jolt into darkness.
Yeah.
Do you get Kathy Hilton in there at all?
Do I ever? It's just always simmering underneath the surface for these women that have so much privilege. And we actually learn in this episode that Tanya's worth $500 million.
Yeah, she's a lot of money.
A lot of money, even more money than I think.
From a shipping heir. Like, she's a shipping heir, which feels like sort of old world almost.
Old
like,
world.
Like, old-fashioned,
Has a weird relationship with her deceased father, who also, who actually, it's more Sutton, if anything, because her, father.
Yeah. We're talking Real Housewives, by the way, guys, sorry.
And there's a lot of overlap, though, because they do go on group trips, and it's actually sort
and
of
I'm sure Mike White watches Real Housewives.
Oh, I'm absolutely sure. Yeah. And I feel like Tanya would fit right in with them. And I will say, I also have a more sensitive Jennifer Coolidge, maybe not as sensitive as yours, but Jennifer Coolidge, like sort of zany sensor in terms of like, what is she actually doing here? And I did really love and appreciate her sort of meltdown at dinner with John and her being, because we think that she's sort of all out here, right? That she's sort of like up in the world, you know, sort of crazy, but she also consents that he doesn't like her. She says, "You don't like me."
Right.
You
Well, she
you
says
hate
you
me,
hate me.
Which is sort of hysterical.
And
but
he's like, "No, I don't." It's like that's a strong word. You should push back against that word a little bit more forcefully than "No, I don't."
Yeah.
I mean, I have questions about Greg. So we open I think it's their first scene in this episode. Yes, it is, because they've just woken up.
Yeah.
And Greg is sitting in bed, kind of staring blankly at the wall, looking troubled, right? And so immediately you're like, okay, what's he up to? Something's happening.
Yeah.
You know, at dinner, he's like, well, I wanted you to have a perfect day before I broke the bad news, which I that's a convention of movies and TV that I never really
get.
That never
actually happens.
Just do it. Don't give them the whole day and then rip the rug out from under them.
Yeah, it's only going to make it worse.
And so then I'm thinking, oh, that's what Greg was worried about in the morning. That's why he was sitting in bed feeling sad, because he or bad or worried or whatever he was feeling, because he got this call from work and was like, shit, I have to figure out a way to kind of break her heart.
Yeah, but actually.
And then at the end, at the very end of the episode, Tanya wakes up, pads out to the bathroom or whatever, and Greg is on the phone with someone kind of disparaging her and then saying, I love you.
I love you.
I think that White is a wilier, trickier writer than to be like, end of episode two, Greg's a fraud. Like,
yeah.
I would have to imagine there's more to be developed with that.
Yes.
Because that would seem too soon for that kind of big turn.
I do think, and I you said this last week, that like while we're definitely supposed to be laughing sort of with or maybe at Tanya, it's sort of confusing. You can feel that like Mike White really does love this actress and really loves and does love this character, and that we are supposed to have some sympathy. So like, you know, seeing, you know, watching Tanya experience that moment or not experience that moment, we'll see if she does. But knowing that he's probably, you know, got a, you know, either a second family or a lover or something like that, I felt a huge pang of just like, oh, she doesn't deserve this.
Well, and it just reinforces why she's so weird. She's so weird because she doesn't know how to love people. She doesn't know how to trust people.
She doesn't know how to be alone.
She's alone all the time, even when she's with people, because she doesn't know what they're there for. You know, they're either an employee or a husband that they've kind of, I mean, the whole thing with the prenup, and he's like, and what he's saying kind of makes sense. He's like, I have to keep my job because if we get divorced, he's an older guy. Like, what am I going to do without a job? That makes sense to me, you know?
100%.
But I don't know. I think you're right about, like, Mike White. Like, he has compassion for Tanya. And yes, bad things are going to happen to her. I have no doubt.
Yeah.
Bad things are going to happen to all these people.
I'm
guessing. But, like, how bad is really the question?
It's trending downwards for her, for sure.
Well, speaking of trending, I kind of feel like Mia and Lucia are trending up.
Oh my God, they won. If there was a ranking of this week, me and Lucia won the week. They are absolutely sitting pretty.
They've got keys to hotel rooms.
They are spending a rich man's money without any sort of, you know, worry in the world. And I, you know what I did? I got up and cheered. I clapped. I said, yes, you girls, you spend that money. You earn this. You deserve this.
Yeah.
It was actually really like empowering for me to see me and Lucia spending Dominic's money.
So you get this scene with Lucia where, you know, she's clearly ambitious. She wants not just to have a boyfriend for the week. She wants to get rich and autonomous and all that.
Mm-hmm.
And she's looking in the store window and she's like, the first thing I'm going to do is fire that bitch. And,
yeah.
You know, so clearly, okay, here are the gears of Lucia's ambition turning.
Yes.
But we also see with Mia that, like, she's not just the sort of meek sidekick.
She's
like,
not a wallflower.
She has ambitions of her own that she realizes in a very small way in this episode, which is kind of cool.
In an amazing way. And I guess this is an amazing time to say that Mia, I love actresses, and the only thing that I love more than an actress is a singing actress.
Yeah.
It's my favorite thing in the world. And Mia gets this wonderful song. She sings sort of ironically, the best things in life are free. You know, you spend the whole episode with her and Lucia spending money, and they're drinking Aperol spritzes, and they're, you know, living their sort of capitalist fantasy, and then she sings this gorgeous jazz standard about how it's actually all about the moon and the stars, and that's all that we need. But it's not true.
Yeah, I mean, they're really interesting characters in the way that they are kind of being played, you know, as the sort of, I mean, we mentioned Rosencrantz and Guildenstern last week, but like, they're the sort of mischief makers. They're kind of running around, you know, they've got Dominic all in his head about whatever, and
but they're meeting other people. They're sort of connecting everybody in a way. That's beginning with, you know, the piano player.
Yeah.
Then Lucia sees Ethan the morning after.
Valentina is clearly annoyed with them.
That was a great scene.
So they're mischievous, but they're also, I think, you know, and maybe I'm projecting just because we've seen the last season and we know Armand and some of the other hotel staff were sort of the moral conscience of the show of that season. But like, Mia and Lucia are, of anyone on the series or this season, like the people you want to root for.
Yes. They are, I mean, it's an ensemble series, but right now my protagonists, my main girlies are Mia and Lucia.
Yeah. With Dominic, the way that he's looking, I mean, I don't mean to dehumanize Lucia, but like the way he's looking at her like she's a bottle of whiskey, it's like, oh, are you, you're a sex addict.
Yeah. You have a problem. You have a literal sort of compulsion.
Yeah. And we see this when he has the girls over, you know, he swore he wouldn't do it again. And then he has not one, but two over.
Exactly. And it was a sort of an offer he couldn't refuse.
And it's this sort of bacchanal where it's like his son is like a room away or something, two rooms away. That's compulsion. And so you do sort of, again, it's kind of, you know, interesting, goes back to Albie, like these men or these people caught in the sort of flux of like cultural shifts and also just personal issues and whatever, where it's like Dominic seems to want to get better because that's like the sort of societally appropriate thing. But it's like, you maybe also need to get better because you have a problem.
Because you have a problem, right? Yeah. And it's not just to save your family and not just because your wife and your daughter aren't, you know, on vacation with you because of the way that you are acting and sort of, you know, parading through society.
So speaking of the DeGrassos and Lucia and Mia, a listener emailed us at stillwatchingpod@gmail.com.
Yep, which you can do too.
Please do. The listener's name is Maddie, and she writes, one theory I have after the first episode is that Lucia could somehow be related to the DeGrassos.
Ooh.
They're in town because their family's ancestral roots are nearby, so that could be a possibility, making Dominic's choice to sleep with her a lot murkier. As for how related they are, of course, would be hard to guess, but obviously the closer they are, the more difficult the situation is. That's a fascinating theory.
Yeah, I didn't know this was the House of the Dragon.
Yeah.
But
so it's possible, you know, Sicily's not that big.
It's not that big, but that would be, I mean, and we don't know. Her name could be Lucia DeGrasso for all we know. We don't know.
Right. Yeah.
But given what has already transpired and what looks like, because, you know, Lucia sort of spent the night at the end of the first episode, and it seems like things were sort of going in that direction at the end of the second episode, that would be, you know, we'd be heading into incest territory, which is something HBO, we do. That's something that happens on these HBO shows. To me, that feels a little far-fetched because I don't know if that's necessarily the story that Mike White is. I don't know if that's sort of in line with my overall theory of what this season is about.
He's not so big on like conspiracy theory, whatever. There are going to be twists because we know that at least one person or several people are dead.
Yeah.
But like, I don't think a dragon's going to burst out of Manhattan or anything. You know?
Yes.
But I appreciate the theory, Maddie. And I mean, it could be true. That I think something that we should be mindful of going forward is as we rewatch episodes, you and I, there is a possibility that White is dropping little clues here. And so this family trip to the ancestral homeland, like maybe that's just there for sort of background color on this family.
Yeah.
Or maybe it's there for a reason. So I don't think we should like
dismiss it. And it could very well. It's honestly, I'm shocked my brain didn't go there myself. Yeah. Honestly, didn't consider that. But that's a good theory.
Yeah. Thanks, Maddie. And keep the theories coming. Still watching. We'll be back in just a moment.
And if you are watching this video, either I'm dead or I'm in a very, very, very bad situation.
She said, oh my God, I can hear gunshots. I can hear men outside.
Where are they? What have they done to them? Are they dead? Are they not dead?
There is one suspect, her father, the Sheikh.
It's Madeline Barron from In the Dark. We've teamed up with our new colleague, Heidi Blake at The New Yorker, to try to answer a question about one of the richest men in the world, the ruler of Dubai.
Why do the women in Sheikh Mohammed's family keep trying to run away?
There's 5 policemen outside and 2 policewomen inside the house. So basically I'm a hostage.
And he reminded me that Sheikh Mohammed can get me anywhere.
Because you're a rich and powerful person, you can effectively break any law you want in our country and get away with it.
The Runaway Princesses is available now. Follow In the Dark wherever you get your podcasts.
So, Chris, now we're going to hear your interview with Beatrice Grano, who plays Mia on the show. Anything small we should know before we listen to this conversation?
Yeah, she was absolutely lovely, and we talked a lot about her big musical moment at the end of the episode. I am so delighted to be talking to you and talking to one of the stars of White Lotus Season 2, Beatrice Grano. Thank you so much for joining me, Beatrice.
Hi, I'm good. I'm delighted to speak to you.
Wow. So were you familiar with the series, The White Lotus, before you joined Season 2? So did you watch Season 1? Did you know Mike White's work?
Like, the series was really famous. It wasn't really famous in Italy. The only people that watched it were people in the, you know, in the industry, because they, of course, they knew about it. But when I got the audition, I watched it again, and I really loved this series. I remember when I was watching it, I was like, I can't watch this, like, because it's just so good. Like, just the idea to be in this project, it's just, this is going to break my heart. So I was like, I can't believe in this. I can't, because it's so good. And I love the way Mike White writes, and the way he sees things. It's very similar to my taste. I love this kind of tragic comedy, and like this very beautiful moment alternates with like awkwardness and like tragic situations. And it just, I mean, I grew up with this. When I did drama school in London, that was my world. I have a theater company in London as well. We do comedy.
Oh, so, wow. What's your theater company called?
It's called Super Glue Assembly Line.
Ooh, I love that. Because,
you know, our shows are ensemble shows, and we all like relate to one another, so we're all like stuck together. And also, we always talk about, you know, everything that happens between taking a decision and not taking it when you're like stuck into something and you can't do it, like super glue. Yeah,
that's so great. It actually really dovetails really nicely into your character of Mia, who you play on White Lotus, who sort of is sort of stuck between decisions, deciding whether she's going to join her friend Lucia, you know, and entertain certain guests at the hotel, and also, you know, is an aspiring singer. So I'd love to hear you talk a little bit about like diving into Mia, and sort of how much agency do you feel that she has in her life? Is she just sort of along for the ride with Lucia, or is she sort of, you know, in control?
She doesn't really know what she wants. Like, she loves to be, she's a dreamer at first, but then she changes her mind, and then she says, I don't want to do this. But then, she, you know, she changed. She constantly, like, transforms into something. And, I mean, it was great to play a character like that, because I've always dreamed of playing, you know, a musician. And I've been playing the piano and singing for a long time. So for me, the idea of merging these two things together was so exciting. I love, you know, that moment in episode 2 where I sit down and play the piano, because I think it's the first time that you actually see some connection between me, what I love, and also with Lucia. We're like, in that moment, we really support each other, and there's so much sweetness. And also the song I sing, it's the best things in life are free.
Yeah, in Crosby Jazz Standard.
Yeah, I love that song. And have you heard of the Sam Cooke version?
Yes, and the Sam Cooke version, of course.
Best. You should it's so beautiful.
Yeah, I know. I definitely want to ask you about that. I want to save that for the end, because I do want to know a little bit about your relationship with Lucia. Sort of, you know, you spend all this time with sort of your best friend, Lucia, who's played by Simona Tabasco. And I would love to know, sort of, did you create like a backstory for how Mia and Lucia sort of became friends, or how they sort of, you know, got sort of became these sort of besties, if you will?
I don't always create backstories, especially in this project that was a sort of a comedy, and like, we just played with it. The thing is, like, me and Simona, we're like, we've been friends for like, in real life, for 10 years.
I've been known for years.
Because we auditioned a long time, we met at drama school a long time ago, then she went, I didn't.
Oh, wow. Ooh, that's a little testy.
Then I went to London, because Italy didn't want me. So I went somewhere else.
Italy's crazy. That's crazy of them. But
I went to London, and I trained there. And then when I got back, I got this job, and it's like an Italian series that it's really famous. It's called, it's like a doctor show. And she was in the series. So I was like, Simona, I met you again. And we became friends. Yeah. And then we became friends working together. And then we did the self-tape together as well for the photos.
And together. You did that. You filmed your audition together.
Crazy. Yeah. Because
that's crazy.
Yeah. She called me and she said, please, I need help. Like, you speak English very well. So I need help with this self-tape. And I read it and I was like, I mean, I auditioned for this too. Like, I'm playing Mia and you're playing Lucia. She goes, that's crazy. So we did it together. It was so much fun. And we kept like thinking about it. Like, can you imagine if this happens? Can you imagine? Can you imagine? But we always like said, can you imagine? Oh, let's stop thinking about this. This is like too beautiful.
But then we
got it together. And then I think that experience of White Lotus really made us, like brought us closer. Like we became really close friends. And we used that a lot. We used that a lot also because we were together in this experience, like two Italian girls, like supporting each other. And that was Lucia and Mia. You know,
I love what you just said about you and Lucia, you know, me and Lucia as being these outsiders, right? In this cast that's full of Americans, and you and Simona are, you know, both outsiders in this cast of Americans, you know, and a lot of sort of like very famous American actors.
I know.
What was that like? Was that sort of intimidating, or were you like, well, I don't, you know, I'm, you know, went to London Drama School, I'm from Italy, I don't care about any of these people. Yeah. What was that dynamic like?
I think for me, it was, I mean, I was going crazy because you know, I love Aubrey Plaza, Michael Imperioli, and like Murray Abraham. So I was like, is this really, like, how is this happening? How am I at this level? I don't know. Will I be good enough? Will I be like good as they are? And so I felt that. I felt that gap, of course. But then at one point I was like, I mean, Mike White was looking for an Italian girl who could play the piano and sing. And he wanted her to have this kind of, you know, pure and innocent vibe at the beginning. I was like,
totally.
This is good for me. Like, I mean, it's like, this is like, I was so lucky that he wrote the character because that was the luck moment. Because when he was writing it, he didn't know that there was an Italian girl there that was just perfect.
Yeah, that was perfect.
That moment was lucky for me. But once I got there, I was like, this is so incredible. I feel so grateful. But at the same time, you know, I'm helping this show as well, because I think
they need you. You're an integral part of the cast, right? You're absolutely necessary. And I love what you just said about Mia being sort of like an innocent girl, at least at first and whatnot. And, you know, in the first episode, you throw a drink at the hotel pianist because he, you know, insinuates that you're a sex worker, right? And which is so crazy. So she's sort of wrestling with, like, you know, what she has to do to sort of get ahead with, you know, and to sort of live the life that she wants, and not wanting to sort of embody the term of, you know, being a, she says, I'm a singer, I'm not a prostitute.
Yeah.
Can you tell me a little bit about like that sort of, that juxtaposition, that sort of like that there's a two forces within her that are at odds.
Yeah. There's something about, you know, that is quite funny. I think Mike White kind of made that up while we were working together, like this joke about my character that, every time I kind of open up, like, I want to be a singer. That's my dream. And on the other side, people like misunderstands it and they go, so you want to have sex? Like,
yes.
They're like this happy because of this. And she goes, no, I'm just being opened, you know, and I'm smiling at you, the piano guy, not because I want to have sex with you, but because you're a musician and I want to be that too. And I think the thing is, like, you know, when you want something really bad that you become so clumsy because you want to get there and you don't think, you're just like, maybe I can do this, this, and this. And then while you do it, you just, you know, you turn everything apart. And like Mia will do so much mess. And it's like, she's clumsy and she doesn't really know. Like, she just wants to play the piano, you know?
And I think that's so important. It's like, I think there's such an amazing, what Mike White does so well is that there is a class distinction, right? It's like Mia and Lucia, there's this 5-star hotel that's in their town that they're not allowed to enter. Valentina says, no, you can't come in, whatnot. And there's so much, you know, opportunity, wealth, connections in there. And if they have to, you know, go via sex work, you know, to make their dreams come true, then why shouldn't they? I was so happy to see in this episode, you and Lucia, when you got in, when you had that scene with Valentina and she was so mad, you know, when Dominic, Michael Imperioli puts your names on the hotel room. Can you talk to me about that? Like Valentina, the relationship between me and Lucia and Valentina and sort of, you know, Lucia even says like, hey, you're a working girl. We're working girls. We're all working here. Yes. We're all trying to get ahead.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, yeah, that's the thing. And it's fun because there's never judgment about it. You know, you normally go, oh, this too poor, like, do you know, what's the word? How do you call it? Do you say baby squillo? No, in English we say...
Ooh, tell me, I took Italian for a minute, so maybe I know this word.
I don't know what to say in English, but you know, like, you know, you see a young girl, like, and she's a prostitute, and you go like, oh, poor little girl, she's a victim, like, this man's fighting, blah, blah, blah. But they just don't care. And the thing is, like, there's no judgment whatsoever. They just, it's a game. They're like, we're going to do this. They're rich people. We are, like, you know, it's fun. It's just, and it's a comedy, you know. The thing about this show is that it's a comedy, and it has so much deep, deep thoughts into it. But at the end, like, you know, we just want to have fun, and we just want to entertain. And I think it was great. It was just great to play that character.
Oh my gosh. Well, speaking of entertaining, and we did talk about this a little bit, I've got to say, your number, your big piano number from episode 2 is so absolutely fantastic. And it is sort of ironic, right? You're singing the best things in life for free. And yet the whole episode, we see you like spending money and like, you know, like, and like spending this man's money. It's sort of like, it's ironic. So how did you come up with what song? How did you guys land on that song? It's sort of perfect for the episode.
I mean, all the songs were Mike White's choices.
And oh, wow.
I'm playing like 5 songs in the show, and they're all like, you know, yeah, and they're all kind of related to, we played it live. I mean, I played it live. So it was very fun for me to like just sit down there and like play that song, because it was a real performance, because I was there, like, and it was really happening. It wasn't pre-recorded, nothing.
Wow.
And I love that song because, you know, it's kind of like, that's the moment where you see me and Lucia being a bit like superficial, like, oh, let's go in, let's go crazy, let's put on makeup. But then we have that moment, we share that moment when I sing, and like, I look at Lucia and Lucia looks back at me almost like moved by the performance. Mm-hmm. So sweet. And the song says, the best things in life are free, which it's basically our love we have for one another, our friendship. Mm. At the end, I think it's the only spontaneous and like truthful relationship in the series.
Wow, that's really,
we're always like really close, and we always support each other. And it's, I mean, I love the fact that, you know, Mike wanted to tell a story of like a female friendship, because you don't always see that. The stars belong to everyone. Flowers in spring, the robins that sing, summers that shine, theirs, they're mine.
I mean, it was so fantastic. And I think something that viewers might not know is that Esty Haim, really, one of the Haim sisters, was a musical consultant on the show. So you worked with her on these songs. So can you please tell me, as a big Haim fan, can you tell me what that was like,
oh,
or what,
God,
you know, how she helped shape the song and the piece?
She was everything that you see. Like, she was like fundamental. And I'm really serious. Also, as a person, I am very, I don't open up straight away. So when she arrived, I was like, oh my God, she's going to tell me how to do things. And I'm like, I didn't even know where to start. And like, I was so scared. Mm-hmm. But her personality is so special that she managed to kind of break that with me. I don't know how. And we really connected. And I remember, because I'm a folk singer, my voice, it's very like breathy voice, but she was
totally
breathy. Breathy is a bad word. Like, what? Well,
no, breathy is great. It's breathy. I think your voice, and I'll tell you, I think your voice is beautiful. It's breathy. It's like, you have a really great belt, but it's like lyrical. It's floaty. It's like,
no,
it's,
I would,
it's very
like,
floaty.
Normally I would sing with a lot of air. She was like, Beatrice, no, you're here. This is your moment. Like, you have to sing it.
She said belt. She said you got to belt it out.
Belt it. Because you have to, like, this is your moment. And I was like, I don't know if I can do that. She was like, yes, you can. And then eventually, like, she really like made me see how my voice can really fly, and I was really happy about it. And also, when she arrived, you know, I'm gonna say, I knew Haim Band, okay, but they're not really famous in Italy, so I don't know. I didn't know the faces straight away.
Totally. I so understand that. That's actually very fair.
So she arrived and we start working together. And then like, I didn't connect it straight away. And then she was singing so well. And I said, Esti, your voice is beautiful. Like, you're a musician, right? And she said, yeah, I have a band with my sisters. And I said, oh, that is amazing. What do you guys do? And then the producer, Dave Bernard, was there. And he said, Beatrice, she's from Haim Band. Do you know Haim Band? I was like,
him.
What?
Sort of a bit.
okay.
That's so funny.
And I was like, I'm so sorry, Esti. Like, I'm so sorry. And then
that's an honest mistake.
I know. And then I messaged my musician's friend back in Italy and I said, this happened to me today. And they were so angry at me. They were like, Beatrice, how could you? They're like, irresponsible.
Oh my gosh, that's absolutely, I think that's the best way to meet Esti Haim. I think that's incredible.
Yeah.
Well, Beatrice, thank you so much for joining me on the podcast.
Thank
it was
you,
so lovely talking to you.
It was so amazing to talk to you. It was great. Thank you.
All right, Chris, now it's time for the final segment of this and every episode of Still Watching The White Lotus. Who's going to die? Just so you know, there is something at stake here.
Yeah, there are stakes.
Whoever of the two of us is right gets an Aperol Spritz.
Yeah, right. And one of those big ones like they have in the show.
Yeah.
Those big orange ones.
Which I kind of hope you win because I think they're so gross.
Oh, my God. Okay, I hope I win, too.
Yeah. Maybe we could alter
maybe
my
Negroni Spagliato for you.
I don't know. Maybe just the Spagliato. Maybe just the Prosecco.
Huh.
But last week, Chris, you thought it might be poor Tanya.
Yes.
I was maybe even darker and said Mia and or Lucia, which I really, after this episode especially, I'm like, I hope that's not true.
Oh, absolutely.
But also another person has weighed in.
Ooh, we have, okay.
A listener named Tanya, coincidentally.
Okay. It wasn't my Tanya, it's not Jennifer Coolidge.
This is not poor shipping here as Tanya. This is a different Tanya who listens to this podcast.
Okay.
She wrote in about Tanya.
Okay, about
Greg.
Tanya. Does she think it's Tanya?
Well, Tanya writes, maybe Greg has a secret family and plans on murdering Tanya for the money, and that's why he didn't want the assistant there.
Mm.
So my guess, this is Tanya writing, is Portia saves Tanya and the three Italian-Americans get dragged into a cover-up because by that time, Portia is fucking the Stanford grad.
Okay, wow, that's a very in-depth theory.
But I kind of like, I mean, that would tilt this show more into like Knives Out territory.
Yes, absolutely.
But, which, hey, you never know.
You never know.
But that's interesting, Tanya. Thank you for writing in.
Yes, thank you for writing in. I think that's very interesting. I mean, I guess from this episode, we learned that like there's a prenup intact, so I don't know how much that complicates the murdering for money thing a little bit.
So I have a new theory.
Okay, what's
Mike's gonna have a new theory every week because that's fun, right?
Yeah, it's fun of it. Yes.
Based on this, we kind of started this episode by talking about this very, I think, thesis-heavy conversation between Portia and Albie. I don't know. I think they might kind of Ophelia together or
no
something.
Way.
Yeah.
Both
I don't
of
know.
Them.
Maybe Albie tries to be like the bold man and saves her from drowning or something.
Okay.
You know, something really tragic like that.
Something, yeah, and he would be ultimate sacrifice as a man.
And it would explain why Daphne's completely, seemingly unaware of these deaths.
Yes, because
right? She's not related to them at all.
It's not in her circle, which again is another thing because my updated theory comes from that moment with Cameron on the phone. I was really, really struck by Cameron screaming about his luggage on the phone. It was very aggressive.
Is he going to kill a Delta employee or something?
Yes.
Yeah.
It's going to be a Delta stewardess. But no, I actually think that we see that he's capable of rage. And, and Daphne says that weird thing that he's got a long fuse, but like...
Sometimes he blows up.
Sometimes
it's
he
funny.
Blows up. It's kind of, yeah, she's like, ha ha ha, it's not a big deal. So given sort of his lascivious sort of attitude toward Harper and their sort of on and off again thing, I was like, maybe they end up hooking up or something and somehow that ends really poorly for Harper. And that's why, her reaction is so crazy. It's like, oh my God, that's my friend Harper who's face down in the Mediterranean. Which
I mean,
is
I could kind of see it. Harper's trying to be adventurous.
Yes.
Maybe she gets on a jet ski.
And those are dangerous.
Yeah. You know, final day. Let me just, get my groove back kind of thing. Oh, interesting. So we're now really mired in tragedy.
Yeah,
of our predictions are sad.
Well, there's no fun prediction, is there?
No, I guess not. No.
But that would be really sad, really tough, because I would hate to see Harper go that way. And I would hate if Cameron were responsible for Harper going. But given his rage, I don't know. I could see it.
Yeah, if you have any strong thoughts about who might be dead, please email us at stillwatchingpod@gmail.com. Give us your theories about who those bodies in the water are. In the meantime, before next week, you can find me on Twitter at Rylos. Chris, where are you?
And you can find me on Twitter at Christris.
Anything at vf.com to plug?
Not basically this podcast, baby, like, so keep
good.
Listening.
I like that focus.
This has been Still Watching from Vanity Fair. Our editor and producer is Dave Gonzalez, and we had production help from Peyton Hayes and Katie Rich. We had technical assistance from Scott Lee. Steven Valentino is our executive producer. Our theme music is by Alexis Quadrado. We'll be back next week for episode 3. Looking forward to seeing you then.
I'm Nomi Fry, and this week on Critics at Large, we're talking about the delights and shortcomings of the new movie Challengers. It starred Zendaya at the center of a tennis triangle and a very steamy love triangle.
Who are her loyalties to? Will she be tempted by the other one? How do these guys reckon their professional playing ambition with the romantic and sexual feelings about this mysterious woman? And such we have it. We have a conflict between three people in a game meant for two.
Is it a sports movie or a sex movie? Find out on Critics at Large from The New Yorker. New episodes drop every Thursday, wherever you get your podcasts. From PRX.